Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Here go.
Let it bump. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knocks podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you, sadly, this time without co-host Andy Bailey, who claims that he has a lot of law school midterms going on at the moment, but I'll leave that to you to decide whether he's lying or not. I am, however, as we keep this season preview train barren along, very excited to be joined by Bleacher Report National NBA featured columnist Grant Hughes, who has been kind enough to devote some of his time to us so that we may discuss the reigning champion, Golden State Warriors. How are you doing today, Grant?
I'm doing great, Dan. Thank you for having me. And what better way to spend our preseason as it dwindles than talking about the best team in the history of the universe?
And you know what's great is that there are probably still some people who will talk themselves into being uncomfortable at hearing that. The resistance to some of the old school resistance to the Warriors now is like laughably funny, where, you know, during their 73 win season, it was, well, listen to it because they haven't like been here yet. But now everything just seems so futile. When you try and argue the contrary, like, it's not a situation where, hey, let's listen to this guy or let's listen to her. It's no, you're just wrong. Like, it don't even bother arguing it.
Yeah, like, that's a weird thing. That happens, like, on a broader scale. I feel like, and you know this, anytime you make a superlative, if you use a superlative about a player who's playing right now, like saying this guy is potentially the best at X or the best whatever, you get pushback no matter what. And it's always like, I don't think you saw Gail Goodrich play or whatever. It's like, well, yeah, all right, I haven't seen a lot of things, but, like, I can tell you that, you know, the game right now is better than it's ever been. The talent level's higher, blah, blah, blah. So, like, whoever's the best right now, to me, it's, like, overly simplistic, but and doesn't always apply, but is, like, the best because this is the highest level it's ever been. And so with the Warriors, yeah, like, you get pushback and people don't want to hear it. But, like, look, you know, they almost set the record for offensive rating last year. Like, they won 73 games a couple years ago. It's just, like, yeah, deal with it, people. Like, this team is historically good. We may not see a team this good for a really long time.
Or, yeah, I guess I'm hesitant to say ever because I'm sure people said that about the Bulls for the longest time. But and your point to the game being better than ever, like, that's just a fact. It's not something to argue, and you can point to that by looking at these massive TV deals or these endorsement deals for the players or their salaries. Like, you know, Stephen Curry making $45.8 million in the final year of his deal in 2021. Like, that's not inflation, people. Like, that's because the league is so good right now.
Right. Yeah. It's a more marketable product than it's ever been. And just like, I always think of it in terms of, like, what do you think LeBron spends per year to, like, keep himself in shape? And, like, what resources is he able to, like, draw on to be able to do what he's doing at this phase of his career? Like, and go back 50 years and guys are, like, just smoking cigarettes at halftime. It's like it's become, like, the full, you know, it's a full, like, lifestyle, and all these athletes are better. Whatever. We've already gone off on our first tangent, like, 2 minutes in, but I think we agree on that.
That means we're in for a good podcast. I measure it by the proximity to the beginning that the first tangent comes. Yeah. With the Warriors, we normally start off by asking for a general impression about their offseason. I don't necessarily know that we need it here because you just look at it and they did nothing wrong. Like, if we want to dive into Kevin Durant, you know, dissing Under Armour or revealing that he has these covert social media accounts, a fact to which not only do I believe, but I love. Their offseason, we could just say, like, it was you. Kevin Durant took like almost $10 million less than he was eligible to make next season. Like, that's, like, you're talking about a finals MVP in the prime of his career. I know he can opt out. I know he can sign with early bird rights next year. Like, that's a big freaking deal.
It's huge. And like, the thing that sort of underscores where this team is, as much as anything, is that, like, it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to do that, right? Like, it was not a surprise, because people that did the math were like, well, if they're going to give Iguodala X to keep him, and they might, the assumption still was they're going to lose Livingston, because I don't think people thought necessarily Durant would take that big of a cut.
Right. We knew he would go non-bird. We didn't know that he was just going to sign for, like, $25 million flat.
Yeah, so, like, even if they'd done nothing else, the extent of that cut and what it allowed them to do just to keep the guys that still matter. Like, Livingston is not a big-minute player anymore. He's a limited guy, but he's really good at the couple things that they need him to do. Like, that matters to just keep those guys. And Iguodala, obviously, is super important still. But if that's all they'd done and just gone with, you know, a couple of back end fillers, then that would have been just like, it's an A+ offseason no matter what. But, you know, they did a little more. They got a little luckier and kept like everybody that mattered, and then added a couple guys in Omri Caspi and Nick Young, who we can talk about more. But yeah, they just hit bombs over the fence like all summer and didn't have to stay really good.
It's amazing that you're bringing back a guy like JaVale McGee or Grandpa West or this injury prone Omri Caspi, and yet it is of course Nick Young who showed up to camp in the worst shape from what we had seen on Twitter. Like, of course.
Like, so my relationship with Nick Young has been like, has not been complicated. I basically thought that he's like a performance artist for the last few years, and like not a helpful player, even though supposedly he started playing defense last year, like contract year, cough, cough. And he had the skill of creating bad shots, so that's not a skill to me. But then like, this is what the Warriors do. When they signed him, I was like, all right, that's too much. I'd rather have given that figure to Caspi and then had Young take the minimum. But then I was like, okay, well, you know what? All he's got to do is shoot the ball, and he's going to get more open shots than ever. And I like talked myself into it a little bit. Like, that's how strong the Warriors like cultural pull is, that I was like, okay, this guy that I've hated forever, he's going to work. Like, he's going to give them 7 or 8 good minutes a night. And then, like you said, of course he Nick Younged it. And it's just like, nah, I don't really care about basketball that much. Like, I'm just going to be out of shape. Like, what, how is this possible that you come into the best situation you've ever been in and just like didn't get in shape?
Right. And it's still a contract year. Like, and it's, you said that about the Warriors culture. Like, I assume the same thing. I like wrote a response to it, and it was initially supposed to be this like tongue in cheek thing. And then it turned into this actual, it wasn't profound, but it was a serious article on how Nick Young is going to be the best version of Nick Young by still being Nick Young because he's with the Warriors. And of course, like that blind faith, Nick Young was able to overturn it because you come into camp out of shape and you're not shooting too well.
Yeah, it had the feel to me initially of like, you know what everybody said couldn't be done? Make JaVale McGee like a serious impact player on a good team. And like, wow, we did that. Like, what could we do? Like, how do we up the ante on this? And like, there's one guy in the whole league, and that was Nick Young, to like see if our culture is strong enough to like just make this person, like you said, the best version of himself. And so far, not so great. I honestly don't think he's going to play. And not just the out of shape thing, but like they've got a couple other guys that are going to need minutes. And if somebody gets squeezed, I think it's going to be him.
I wouldn't blame them. Like he can probably still be, you would think, in this, on this team, and the quality of looks they generate for people that don't have to dribble, he should be able to knock down, catch and shoot threes, but he's going to be the garbage time guy. And I'm not going to say it's nice that like he might become an issue where like, oh, he's not playing, or he showed up to camp out of shape and then never really came back from that. But like, the Warriors cannot just take away all our favorite punchlines, you know? Like, we don't get to joke about him anymore. Like, what are they going to do, sign Josh Smith and get him the Sixth Man of the Year award at some point? Like, we need to have something. They can't ruin that for us. They've already destroyed the competitive landscape.
This is the ultimate Warriors ripple effect question, and you just uncovered it. Like, we've got JaVale McGee, he's off the board. You can't make him the joke. Nick Young's off the board, probably. Who knows? So who's like the next guy? Who's gonna carry that mantle of the guy who's just like, you know, is the joke, and you just wait for him to do something bad or dumb? Like, Jordan Crawford's around, but Jordan Crawford is more of like a former Warrior too, by the way.
Yeah.
so that, hey, you know what? Their culture wasn't what it was, but they couldn't save Jordan Crawford. And so now he's like going to matter for some team. New Orleans, maybe? Is that where he is?
Yeah. And he actually played well for them down the stretch of last season. You know, I don't know who that guy, like, we don't have J.R. Smith anymore, thanks to LeBron. Maybe he'll act out a little bit now that he was displaced from the starting lineup. But it's I don't know who that next guy is. And like, now I'm angry at Cleveland and Golden State for doing this to us.
Get after it. You know what? I want Malcolm Brogdon to be that guy, just because that would be the most off-brand move for him. Like the president, just become a knucklehead. That's what I want. I want him to play against type. We need somebody to do it.
Maybe Dion Waiters. Like I don't even know. Like, he turned into like this serious player, then he goes to Miami.
We gotta stop getting these guys on functional franchises. The Kings need to step up and get somebody and let him just go full knucklehead. And New Orleans seems like a good spot for that. You need these dysfunctional franchises to snap these guys up, because we're losing a great a great cultural resource when these guys like straighten out.
I still have hope for the Kings there because it's so Kings that when they sign Zach Randolph to like be this mentor and high character guy, that I don't care that he got arrested for weed. And I know, you know, his lawyer maintains he was innocent. Like the charges were like, I don't know, they were like basically vacated or became a misdemeanor, but it was so Kings that that's what they signed him for. And then he's all of a sudden arrested. Like, so they, yeah, they're still, the Kings still have that juju on them.
Oh yeah, I got high hopes for the Kings in that regard. I think everybody's a little too high on that offseason, and so something's gonna go get screwy. It's a guarantee.
Yes, we talked about that. I remember you were pretty as hot as you can get about something Kings related. You were pretty heated about the way they spent their cap space this year.
Yeah. I mean, listen, if you haven't done the Kings preview yet, I'll happily come back and give you all my thoughts on that. Yeah. I just think
it wasn't as aggressive because we actually did it and you weren't on it. So that's a missed opportunity.
The Kings are still – the Kings stay the Kings. That's like – that's just – they're never going to get away from that. And they've done a few things well, but, you know, they can't do everything right. That's never going to happen.
The other thing that's not really related to the Warriors' actual preview, and it's really tough to find stuff that's worthy to talk about, that would be that report from the Athletic that Joe Lacob wanted to offer Stephen Curry less than the max. Does Bob Myers deserve like some sort of a medal for talking him out of that? Because that's, I understand, like, they didn't screw Stephen Curry in his first contract because a lot of people, they were either uneasy about that $44 million deal at the time, or they were like, you know, that's, you know, he has ankle problems, like that's market value. But to ask like the two-time MVP who just spent, you know, that deal turned into the best deal in the NBA by the time year one was over, basically.
Right.
I honestly shocked me. Like, I knew Kevin Durant took the pay cut. We had joked about it, I think, on the podcast a couple of times. Like, imagine if Joe Lacob just asked Stephen Curry to take less, or that the Warriors did that in general. And to find out that that was even on the table to ask, like, thank God Bob Myers didn't even bring that offer, like, to the discussions.
Yeah, I mean, two things. You're 100% right that, like, at the time, like, Curry did not take a pay cut to signing that 4-year deal. The risk was really there. Like, I remember writing the reaction to that and being like, it's worth it, I think, but it's a huge risk because this guy just like might not be able to play full seasons, and that's just like, that was the reality at the time. So it's not a pay cut. But that's not the same thing as saying he wasn't grossly underpaid. It was the best contract in the league. I have no idea how. I think Lacob is a guy that essentially, you know, he's a venture capital guy. He is like a super like Ayn Rand devotee. Like, he is someone who I think would take the approach of like, well, you're never going to know the answer unless you ask for it, you know, as far as like unreasonable requests that could potentially save him money. But yeah, Myers, like, you know, Curry has made the franchise so much money. Like, if you distill everything down, all this great, you know, stuff they've done, like, it really does start with Curry being the type of player that no one foresaw him becoming. So yeah, I don't know how that conversation went. I imagine it was pretty short, but it was probably wise not to upset the guy who is essentially responsible for your franchise being what it is.
Well, that's how unfathomable it is that it probably was. It might have just been, you know, I make fun of him before, but like, maybe it was just this like innocuous inquiry and he found out just how quickly Bob Myers rebuffed it and that was it. Because it's so unfathomable that I can't even begin to think about like what it obviously would have been poorly received, but like, what are the repercussions of that? Like, are they just able to turn around and then be like, oh, we were just kidding, like, here's your $201 million and it's fine? or does he actually just like go shop it? Like, that's how unthinkable the notion was.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, like, I guess if you want to really look into it, if there's a guy who is sort of like, I don't know, professional is a weird word to use, but like, if there's anyone that could take like a low ball like that and still not just destroy a locker room and like cause this huge, like, I want out thing, it would probably be Curry, just because he'd be like, nah, how about 201? What do you guys think about that? And then they'd have to say like, yes, absolutely, sir.
Yeah. I mean, Kevin Durant saying no one wants to wear Under Armours at first, and then Joe Lacob talking about giving him less than max money. Like, that's quite the offseason for Stephen Curry being stabbed in the back.
Yeah, he's just like, you can't, he's unflappable. He's like the most polished. He, you know, if there's a criticism of him, is that he's a little boring because he's in a calculated way. He just is wired to not like allow stories like that to become distractions. And he never says anything in media scrums by design. And he just is, he's just about his business. Like, and it's a part of the, it's like, in terms of superstars to play with, like, that's what makes him so easy, because he just diffuses like anything that would potentially mess up his team's chemistry.
Yeah. And it was, it's so pointless to like worry about like anything with him. Like, he's just become so automatic. Like, remember, it was kind of before the All-Star break, he wasn't really hitting his pull-up threes. And then like after the All-Star break, he just shot 38%+ on them. And that might've been considered like his downturn. It's just, he's so reliable from that standpoint that it's boring, like you said, like on the character front, because you can't hope that he's going to give you this really aggressive, you know, forceful, brazen response. And then on the court, it's just, okay, you know, Stephen Curry's going through a shooting slump, but we know that it's not going to stay that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a little bit like, and these are the types of comparisons you have to make with a team like this. It's a lot like Tim Duncan, where if your best player is the most low maintenance guy on your roster, although I guess probably Klay Thompson would give Curry a run for that, then like it's really easy for everything to fall into line. And that's another thing that makes the Warriors what they are, is that like Curry is not a guy whose feathers get ruffled, and he doesn't ruffle feathers. So it's like, if you're going to look for distractions or drama or something, it's just not going to come from him. And that sort of defines like the you know, the makeup and sort of the attitude of the team.
And I think that's all part of what would this question becomes. He's more important to the Warriors than Kevin Durant, correct? And he might even be, despite just public perception, and despite like what we're going to see in rankings, and despite a Finals MVP, like there's a case to be made that Stephen Curry is still the second best player in basketball, or at least, if you want, at least better than Kevin Durant, just because of what he does and how he bends defenses with his just uninhibited shot selection. Where so much of what Durant does, and I'm not even downplaying it, and I don't want that to be misinterpreted, but because he has that length and he's so tall, like he's just able to rise and fire over everybody. Curry doesn't necessarily have that advantage, and he just warps defenses because there's just no spot. Like, you're just not safe from anywhere. And because he's willing to work off the ball, and not in just a standstill role, but he'll cut like crazy. And I do think, obviously the Warriors help him out on defense a lot, but I've never looked at him as a bad defender. Like, he's, even statistically, he's mostly an even defender. They don't have to quote unquote stash him 75% of the time like these other point guards. I always thought, well, I guess not always, he's been playing with Kevin Durant for a year, but like as soon as it was just assumed, like even by the end of last season after that Finals run, that, oh, Kevin Durant's just still the second best player in basketball. Like, I just think there's a case to the contrary to be made there.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, and I think it is a complicated question that I think, depending on sort of where you are, so put it this way, I think if you pulled players, and it's like, and we'll actually see this with the All-Star game, like, I think Kevin Durant is someone that players would say, oh, he's harder to guard, he's so tall, he's so long, he can get a shot whenever you want. Players always favor the guy like that. That's why players still think Carmelo Anthony is so much better than everyone else does, because like, oh, he's physically difficult to guard, and he has these tools, these conventional tools. But I think most, and again, like, you can't have this conversation without it seeming like you're denigrating Durant, which like, that is not what this is about. Like, absolutely. if he's not the second best player in the league, then he's like third or fourth or whatever.
Right.
But for Curry, like you said, he's never going to make the defensive impact that Durant makes, which he just decided to start making last year as a rim protector. But Curry is a guy that just from the moment like it flipped for him, basically under Kerr, and just a little bit at the end of the Mark Jackson tenure, but not quite. From the moment he sort of became what he is, which is really like the first guy to just be a threat from 30 feet with a live dribble, he fundamentally alters what defenses have to worry about in a way that Durant just doesn't. And you know, maybe there's going to be a few more guys that do that. You've already seen like Damian Lillard is sort of a pale copy of that. Like Isaiah Thomas did a little bit of that last year. But just to have a guy that inverts the areas of the floor that you're supposed to worry about, meaning like, well, it used to be nothing in the paint, nothing in the paint. Now it's like, well, we can't let Curry get loose from 30 feet. That changes everything about a defense, and the effect that has on your team offensively is what makes him, I think I agree with you, whatever you want to say, more important, like objectively better is like a scarier thing to say, but maybe is also true. But I think that's just what it is. Like, he's a paradigm shifter, and Durant is really good, Hall of Famer, great player, MVP. But he doesn't have the same effect on like the fundamentals of how basketball is played as Curry does.
Right. And just the impact that that has on his teammates. And you even see it with Durant, whose job on offense becomes so much easier in a way where even if you told me that Russell Westbrook would cut his usage in half and was willing to play off the ball more, like, Kevin Durant's job still doesn't get that convenient, essentially, when it's Russell Westbrook as opposed. And then the argument obviously becomes, yes, Stephen Curry is better than Russell Westbrook, but to alter the game for so many of his teammates in a way that's so translatable to me. And we talk about, and Kevin Durant is one of those players that you can just imagine saying, well, yes, he's the rare star that can fit in like anywhere, because the argument was for the Warriors, Kevin Durant would be easier to welcome in than LeBron James last year. And that was absolutely true. Stephen Curry's like the same way, but even to an even bigger extent.
Right. Well, it's like the measure of, so often you hear the measure of a player is like, is how much better does he make everybody else? And a lot of times that's attributed to like, well, that's like the Lonzo Ball thing. Like, oh, you know, his passing is infectious. He gets guys to run the lanes because they're going to expect the ball, and that makes guys better. And, you know, the Magic Johnson thing, John Stockton, whoever you want to use, Curry makes guys better in totally different ways just because of the attention he draws, the places he draws attention, which is like everywhere, but especially really far from the basket. He makes guys better in ways that Durant cannot, and that really nobody else can. And it forces you to think about the game differently. But I think if you're really looking at it critically, that's kind of undeniable, the impact that he has.
Yeah, and I guess we've all, both you and I, have just lost followers, I think, since that conversation ended.
That's all right. Listen, we were here to speak the truth, or whatever we think the truth is.
And that might be the degree to which we can manufacture any drama with the Warriors. It's like you wrote about this, I think, once or twice over the summer, that complacency is probably their biggest concern. And then you went on a search in another article that I really enjoyed, like in looking for other weaknesses, and you came up with like bench scoring and creation, and then there were the turnovers. It seems like that's been sort of the same trope since they became really good. And then at the end of it, it's just kind of like, do we worry about Draymond Green shooting when he shot lights out from three in the playoffs? It's just, I find it, is there anything to actually worry about with this team? And assuming the answer is just complacency, like, what is that even a real and ever-present danger?
Well, like, as a blanket rule, you gotta like not include injuries as part of this discussion, because that applies to everybody.
Right.
But so complacency is like where you have to go, because it's hard to repeat. Teams, you know, there's this malaise of winning a title, and like, sorry, you're gonna have to cough button that out.
We need a cough button.
Yeah. Well, then I'm gonna cough again. I'm gonna repeat my cough. So like, the idea that the Warriors are going to coast, or they're going to build bad habits, or they're going to whatever, take it easy, like, that's appealing, partly because like that's what we need to believe to sort of infuse some tension or unpredictability into a season that may not have much otherwise, but partly because it's just logical, like that happens. But to me, like, the way that they're wired and the way that they've got these guys that just manufacture challenges where they aren't real, where like Draymond Green remembers everybody drafted ahead of him. Curry like didn't win the MVP, so he's got a reason to get after it. And Klay Thompson, just like, his emotions don't ever change, so he doesn't know how to coast. And like Durant, still Kevin Durant, and maybe he wants to just really stick it to the Thunder. They're always going to find these things. Does that mean that, you know, that doesn't change the fact that they may rest guys more, that they may not, you know, try to gun for a bunch of wins because that came back to bite them a couple years ago? I just think the complacency thing is a straw that you grasp at. But to me, it doesn't seem realistic that this is going to be an issue for them just because of the types of guys that make up the team.
Would there be anyone better in the league to generate like fake chips on the shoulder than Draymond Green to keep a team like this motivated? I'm trying to think of one, and I just can't come up with anybody.
No, that's the thing. Like, whatever. I mean, he's a totally unique player. His skills are, he's got a package of skills that we just like haven't really seen before. But like that might be his best, is that like it is not hard to make him feel slighted. Like he's, and this is true of like every NBA player, I think, to some degree. Everybody, they all just have this wiring of like, nobody believed in me. And that motivates me. Even if you're someone like Steph Curry, who like everybody has always believed in you, dude, like you're, you know, I mean, I don't care if you went to Davidson, like everybody acknowledged you're one of the best players in college, et cetera. Everybody they all have that, but Green's is like to this insane degree, where, yeah, you're right. Like if the locker room is down, like guess who's going to be screaming? Like guess who's going to be yelling at Steph Curry to like pick it up? Like how many guys can do that? And Green is just wired that way.
It's, yeah, and that's why the complacency argument, it's a valid one just because we're talking about a team. It's so hard to get to four straight NBA finals no matter who you are. And the Warriors, they have some, like, fresh blood in there because Durant is only 1 year into his tenure. But, like, that, like, it seems almost with this team that you have to just say injuries, like, is the biggest threat. And that's the disclaimer that we leave out because it's not a real one. And even, you know, you look at the Warriors – Klay Thompson, Stephen Curry, Draymond Green, over the past three seasons during this tear, have missed a combined 31 games. And the feeling should be, well, at some point that luck is going to run out. But they also didn't have Kevin Durant for 20 last year and were just fine. And we're looking at a team that ended, I hope I don't get this number one, they were 31-2 last year, right, towards the end of the playoffs and the regular season. Like it was.
I think that's right.
So we talk about them not gunning for wins. They weren't necessarily gunning for wins last year until they got to the playoffs. They end up with 67 in the regular season. It feels like they could take that same path or enter some quasi cruise control and still just end up with 70. And that's, you know what, take 20 games of Kevin Durant away, take 20 games of Stephen Curry away. Like they just have so much residual star power that does that even matter when we're using that super long shot argument of, well, injuries could hurt this team.
Well, yeah, and you know what? I think it's a longer shot argument for them than for a lot of teams. It's easy to sort of talk yourself into the idea that, well, they've been healthy and nobody stays healthy forever, therefore they're going to have injuries this year. To me, there aren't that many teams that manage players' minutes better than the Warriors do. I mean, believe me, like I do not have insight into the metrics they use and like what they're, you know. I know they use a bunch of biometric stuff in practice and they manage guys' load and they can tell when guys are fatigued. But their minute totals are low. Like they just don't play guys more than like 33, 34 minutes. And they sit guys for entire fourth quarters a lot because they build these big leads. So, you know, if anything, there are times where you're like, man, this guy needs some more reps. Like this guy needs to play a little bit more. But they just don't do it. They have this window where they know how long they can play guys. Like look at JaVale McGee, for example, he averaged less than 10 minutes a game last year. And that's by design because they're worried about his health and just him holding up. And that's, they have that approach for every single guy. They know what they can get out of him before the risk starts to get, like unpalatable. And they don't play guys like 45 minutes. It doesn't happen. So to the extent you can mitigate the risk of injuries, like they're about as good at it as anybody. So even that is one of those things where you're like, yeah, injuries might be an issue, but they're not ordinary even in that regard.
And do the turnovers or the, you know, the bench scoring or the shot creation outside of Stephen Curry and Kevin Durant, do either of those issues actually bug you at all when looking at this team's trajectory?
I mean, I don't. So the turnovers are the one that, you know, they bother Steve Kerr the most. And it's sort of the most frustrating, I guess, as an observer, just because like, so for the Warriors, the expected value of an offensive possession is just higher than for anybody else, just because of how good they are. So like a turnover is somehow worse because it's like, well, you just cost yourself like more than a normal turnover would cost because you were going to hit a three or whatever. But like they're just indivisible from how they play. It's been a point of emphasis though, I know, in training camp, to the extent they've had one with this China trip, that like they want their passes. These are the details you can focus on when you're at this level. Like they're trying to make sure their passes like are more accurate in terms of like timing and being in a player's shooting pocket and all this stuff. So they're going to work on that stuff, but like, if you play this high wire brand, like, and your whole offense is predicated on guys like sprinting everywhere all the time, you're going to turn it over. And I just think that like, if you try to curtail that too much, then you diminish like a lot of what makes this team good. So you're just gonna have to live with it. And it doesn't, to me, rise to the level of like, this is fatal. Because I think, like, for all the talk of it, I think, I don't know what they ranked in like turnover frequency last year, but it wasn't like they weren't last in the league. So they were 20th. That's bad. They've turned it over on 14.4% of their possessions. Not great, but like this, the Hornets turned it over the least, and they're at 11.7%. So like, not fatal, definitely not
right,
fatal.
And all at, like, the top five pace. So
yeah, you're gonna have a raw number, and that's gonna be high. But who cares? Shot creation on the bench, that's an issue. Unless our buddy Nick Young just creates a lot of bad shots, which are just turnovers by a different name. But yeah, they're going to have these little flaws. But I mean, like, they lost Ian Clark, and they're going to give those minutes to Patrick McCaw, who is, you know, everybody thinks he's going to be better. Caspi's going to suck up some of those minutes, and like, boom, they're you're set. So, those little things, it's hard to get worked up about them. We have to talk about them, because you're always looking for flaws, but I don't know. I mean, they're not things that I think they're worried about, frankly.
Nor does it seem like they should be. The other thing I was wondering if you can explain, and I'm not sure if this is just because Draymond Green didn't shoot well in the regular season from three, or if Andre Iguodala, like, for someone who plays on a team like the Warriors, him shooting at basically a league average clip or a little bit lower isn't great. Like, the death squad was shooting under 34% last year when they were from three in the regular season when that lineup was in there. And then in the playoffs, I think they were under 32% from three, if I was mistaken. I can't remember what that number was, but they were at 33.9% in the regular season, the death lineup from three. And then during the playoffs, they were at 33.3%. And I always just found that odd, because it seems like that's a lineup that should be, I don't know if it's just, and a Green shot better in the playoffs. So I'm just wondering if you can just explain that to me, or if that's an anomaly we're just not going to see materialize again.
I'd say mostly anomaly, but that is true. Like, the death lineup, like, they kind of sucked last year, and like relative to 2 years ago. That's another thing. The Warriors actually weren't very good in clutch situations. They after being like historically good 2 years ago when they won 73. So if you're looking, I mean, the league is not hoping to hear this, but like, if you're looking for reasons why the Warriors could be better, like, that's a huge thing, is that lineup has to be better. And a lot of the sort of discomfort, I guess, with that group had to do with, I think, Curry and Durant, like, figuring out what to do and how to play off each other. You know, famously, they sort of decided midway through the year that, okay, Curry needs the ball more, because off the ball, it's just easier for teams to beat him up. And it's just, we're just better when he has the ball. Whatever happens after he initially has it is good. And that really, you know, they got a lot better midway through the year when they made that decision. But for me, like, expecting that line, that closing lineup of Thompson, Curry, Durant, Iguodala, and Green to do anything but just be dominant is a mistake. And the thing you alluded to about the three-point shooting particularly, that's another thing. Curry shot the lowest percentage from three in his career last year. He was like 41.4 or 41.1, never been lower. Thompson shot it worse from three than he had since like 2012-13. Durant shot it worse from three than he had since 2010-11. Like, that's not going to continue. These, like, they're too good of shooters, and the quality of looks they get are too good. So I think all three of those guys are going to shoot it better. So that affects the death lineup. That affects the offense as a whole. So that's kind of one of the, like, my hot take is that I think they're going to have the highest offensive rating in history this year. Like, I just think it sounds insane. But like, that's just one of those things that, like, if you look at it objectively, like, those three guys should all shoot it better. So what does that do for your offense? I think it's going to be like historically good.
I don't really have a rebuke to that either. it just seems like kind of a fact. And the clutch situations, and I remember reading that, and I guess I just didn't notice it because it's so hard to even, like, sometimes it's hard to go, like, nuanced into the Warriors and looking for problems because you don't think you're going to turn up anything. You brought up the great point about Kevin Durant and Stephen Curry kind of getting acclimated to one another. There almost has to be a situation where it's like, how much was that where they just decided to come back because they fell down behind by too many, or like they just weren't used to being in clutch situations, period, because they were just blowing out teams and they were so used to garbage time anyway. Like, there's, for the starters, like there's a point in the season where it's almost like, oh wow, we're playing in the fourth quarter, this is freaking weird.
Well, the thing, like the narrative of this team 2 years ago before Durant was that, like, in the 73 win season, they would kind of half-ass it for like good chunks of the game because they knew they'd have a 5 minute spurt with usually the death lineup where they just outscore the team, the opponent, by like 14 points in 5 minutes and boom, game over, like, or whatever it was. And that, and so that was like how they played. And I think it was just different this past season. Whether that's Durant and Curry figuring it out, whether that's the expectation that we know we can play 5 minutes at a time and just win games that way, maybe leading to some, there's that complacency we were talking about. I don't know. But like, this is the other thing. They broke out the Curry Durant pick and roll in the finals. And it was just unstoppable, obviously. And Kerr doesn't like to use it because he wants the ball to move. He wants everyone to get a touch. And the Warriors were the lowest. They devoted the fewest percentage of possessions to plays finished by the pick and roll ball handler and the roll man last year. So like, that's, they've got that too, right? If like, if they bog down in clutch situations or whatever, they can go to that. And I think Kerr is comfortable in the right moments using it. You won't see it a lot, but like, that's the ultimate, it's the ultimate ace in the hole, is they can just do that. They can run a pick and roll with two guys that you can't guard, and there's going to be no fix for that.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see if they would break it out more in the regular season. I almost just wonder how much of it is, you know, no one can guard it no matter how much they plan for it, but maybe you still just don't want to break it out too often so that it becomes just this commonplace thing that maybe teams are able to figure out how to adjust at some point. But I, nothing, and there are basketball minds way smarter and more nuanced than I am. Nothing springs to mind, though, of what anyone could begin to do against that.
Yeah, like, that's the call definitely out here, is that anytime something went wrong last year, there's like, oh, Kerr, why doesn't Kerr just run more pick and roll? That's what everybody runs, and they've got these two guys. And even I was like, I was of that mind too. It's like, why wouldn't you just do the best thing all the time? Like, it's, there's the, why not? And then Kerr made good points. Like, hey, guess what? Steve Kerr is smarter about basketball than I am. Like, can you believe it? Like, he said like, no, it's just, I just want everybody to touch the ball because I think they play better all around if they feel like they're like doing something other than standing still and waiting for a kick out, which is true. It's true. But he still has that, and it's nice to have that for sure.
And I'm wondering almost how much of their like crunch time struggles were just a little bit of them. Like, is the ball just not moving as much, or they just, because it seems like they use a lot of teams that, yes, they get slower in crunch time. Like, the Warriors are a fast team, and they didn't even come close, I believe, to ranking in the top 10 in pace in crunch time. And again, we're working with a 25 game sample here. I looked that up while you were talking. Like, they went at 25 of their games went into like the final 5 minute disclaimers. And is that just something like you're so not worried, but like the focus becomes like, well, we're just going to have Steph and Kevin Durant either or shot create, and that's going to, you know, kind of bog down the offense a little bit because it's not as free flowing as it was throughout the first, you know, 40, 43 minutes of the game.
Yeah, I think that was an issue. And like, you know, if you consider where Durant came from and how the Thunder played, it was a your turn, my turn thing, like to the nth degree, to, you know, that's what the Thunder's offense was with Durant and Westbrook. And so I know that Durant, like, he really struggled with, last year when he would pass the ball, he would stay where he was. And that's like not, that doesn't fly in Kerr's offense. You pass and you move and you cut or you screen or you do something. Like, stagnant stuff just is not what the Warriors want to see. And so I think especially at the end of games where Durant's, you know, mentality is, I get the ball, I'm going to score. And Curry's mentality, even though he does it differently, is kind of similar. They did slip into your turn, my turn stuff. And that did bog it down. I don't expect you'll see that again, but it's always going to be kind of tricky, when you've got two guys like that, that should, you know, all things being equal, be thinking like, all right, I'm going to get, this is my time, you know?
Kind of moving off that. And we spend so much time talking about Stephen Curry, Kevin Durant, and then even Draymond Green throughout all this, as what Klay Thompson does for this team become almost underrated. I know, I wouldn't say there was like this huge uproar when SI.com ranked him as the 20th best player in the league entering this season. I did find him particularly hard to place when I was doing NBA 100 for Bleacher Report, which I'm still working on. And, you know, I used our colleague Adam Frommel as like this guy to bounce these rankings off of, and he kept trying to get me to pull down Klay Thompson lower. And I understand that, like, he averages, at, I don't know how many times I've said this, like, negative dribbles a game at this point. But, like, he still works on the defensive end. Like, the assignments he covers are tough. And then the bigger thing to me, and I'm not sure how much this needs to weight into these types of rankings or how we view a player, but you try and get another 20-something to just buy into this role when he's an all-star, when people are prepared to call him a top 20, 25 player, where a majority of his shots, they're coming off cuts and just off the catch. And we have to imagine, what would it be like if someone else with his skill set was in this role? Would they buy into it as much? And then for me, the other part of it, we also have to project, like, I think he could, he would never be as efficient if he was like the number one option on a team, but he can do more. He can score off the dribble. We've seen in the past, not so much anymore, I feel like, but that he's been able to score in the post on smaller guards. I am at the point where I feel like even when a lot of the defensive metrics, like, they don't necessarily favor Klay Thompson all the time, but I think that's one of the hills that I'm just prepared to die on now, is that Klay Thompson has somehow become underrated. And if you don't think he's a top 25 NBA player, I don't know what the argument is against that. Are you just uncomfortable, unnerved by saying, oh crap, the Warriors have four top 25 players in the same lineup? I don't know what else there is to argue against that.
It's tough, because, like, so much of what works in his favor and makes him great can sort of also be used to make the case that he's overrated. Just, you know, he's inarguably in, like, an optimal situation. As a guy who is, he does have these other skills that you mentioned. He did post up a ton when Mark Jackson was coach, and everybody hated it, but he wasn't bad at it, because he's always going to be bigger than the one or the two that's guarding him. But, like, just as a catch and shoot guy, he is phenomenal. That, like, this is not a revelation, and it's hard to find a better place to be a catch and shoot guy than playing with Curry and Durant. So he's in a position where, like, he's never ever asked to do things that he's not great at, and all they want him to do are the things that he's awesome at, which is basically defend and shoot when he's open. And so you could say that, like, well, if he's somewhere else, they might ask him to do more. That's definitely cutting into efficiency, and maybe that, you know, wears him out or whatever. I think that, like, I agree, the numbers don't always love him on defense, but on the ball, he's just so big and he's so dialed in that he's a great defensive player. He's not awesome off the ball, because as Klay Thompson's whole, like, makeup suggests, like, he's a little spacey sometimes, but in terms of what he's asked to do and how he makes this team better, I don't know if there's a guy that you could put into his role that would fit better. And I mean, they didn't trade him for Kevin Love, right? And they decided that they wouldn't trade him for Paul George. So to me, like, they're aware of that, the Warriors are. And top, I don't know, I, you know, the ranking is tough. I don't envy you for having to figure that out. But he, in his role, is just like, there's nobody that would fill it better. I don't know who you'd pick.
I just, even the bigger thing for me, like, someone, he's still scoring, so it's so tough. Like, his scoring average was, considering, like, what happened to the Warriors, they added Kevin Durant, and to see his scoring average just go basically unchanged or whatever it ended up being, like, that's incredible. But he's, the defensive thing, and, like, I get the space out issues, and I even, when I was looking, I saw that he covered more ground per game this past year than anyone on the Warriors, and that seems like raw ground covered, because it always seems like he's chasing guys on the ball a lot more than everybody else on this team, where it's not as much switching. And I'm not sure whether that's impressive, whether it's not, like, he's become sort of an enigma. And I think I've just started to lean toward the slant of, no, this guy's become underrated because he's seriously good at basketball. And I'm done penalizing players because they're in their optimal roles. Like, if it was an issue of playing time, if it was an issue that we're seeing his shot totals crater or his defensive assignments are getting noticeably easier, I get it. Like, I had to resist putting Andre Iguodala, like, higher than I did. And I think where I eventually put him, it'll still make people a little uneasy, but he's not going to play as many minutes, and he's in this more of a small burst role, even though he's so wicked important to what the Warriors do, particularly defensively in the playoffs. But Klay Thompson, like, I just feel as if he shouldn't be subject to those caveats.
I think that's a really, not to get too like basketball philosophical, but
let's do it.
Let's think about this. I think one of the worst things you can have on a team is a guy who absolutely has to be the best player, but if he is your best player, you are going nowhere. This was back in the day for Warriors fans. This was Monte Ellis. For the Kings, that's DeMarcus Cousins. And for the Pelicans, not so much now because Anthony Davis is there. But like, if that's the worst thing, the best thing is a guy who could theoretically be the best player on a lot of teams, but appreciates that he's in an optimal situation and doesn't want more, right? And that's Thompson, because like you said, he could go somewhere and get 30 if he got 25 shots a night. Easy, no problem. But I think he's already talking about taking less on his next deal. Like that is, I mean, there just aren't a lot of guys.
The Bay Area
like
must
that.
Have some great weed if oh, that's just man. What he's talking about.
I think it's recreationally legal on January 1st too. So, I mean, he's not even going to have to jump through any hoops anymore. so the thing like that's hugely valuable. So you're right. We shouldn't penalize a guy for being in an optimal situation. Maybe we should celebrate that like he's cool with it, because it's letting him do the most that he can do in a limited way. And that's super hard to accept for a lot of players.
And it's, I mean, even down, I know he got $80 million from Anta, and I hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. But like that's so Klay Thompson is like, he could be with Nike. Like he could right. be with Jordan or Adidas. And yes, he got his $80 million from Anta, but like what, like someone in his position, like I don't think you could have, if Anta came in and outbid like Kevin Durant with the Nike thing, like it wasn't the whole spiel that Under Armour was actually offering more for Kevin Durant and he still went to Nike. And I'm not, again, Klay Thompson's getting $80 million from Anta, but it's right down to the shoe company that he represents. Is he's so different from another 20-something all-star in his situation, because I feel like there are people, we saw it with Kyrie Irving, and I don't want to draw that relationship because it was so different, but Kyrie Irving got sick of being sort of the underlord in Golden State, and he actually had time as the guy in Cleveland before LeBron James came along. It was never a situation where the Warriors dangled something in front of Klay Thompson and took it away the way Cleveland did with LeBron's free agency and when they re-signed Irving. But guys at this point in their career, like he could want more, and yet we're all worried about when will the Warriors have to bust this up because of luxury tax reasons, and he's like, hey, you know, I might take some less just to stick around.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like I always hate to make it's hard to resist it, but I hate to make the value judgment on like Kyrie's decision, right? Because, you know, it's just, if you look at him as an employee, maybe he thinks that he can do more, and that's an irrational belief based on everything we've seen. His teams can't win if he's another guy, maybe that if he's your best player, it's hard for you to really have that high of a ceiling. But like, I don't want to say like, oh, that's selfish or that's whatever, but it is different. And if you're looking at what makes teams really good, it's having more guys like Thompson in terms of like, you know, how high maintenance they are, or what they need emotionally. And it's harder with guys like Irving. And that, you know, there are a million things like this with the Warriors where it's like, this is just one of those things that they're so lucky to have that has put them on this trajectory. But Thompson's sort of whole makeup is definitely one of those things that's allowed them to be what they are.
And Irving was another guy who's tough to place on those lists, because like part of me just wants to put him behind Kemba Walker, because Kemba Walker's defense is so underrated, but it's just like those guys are just tough to rank. And I again, like I said before, now that we're running in circles, I lean more towards the Thompson is underrated stance on that now, at least at this point. The other thing I was going to ask you, Draymond Green, one, do we see improved shooting from him compared to last year? I know he's getting fewer attempts. That's another guy who's just made sacrifices and basically said, well, I'm going to be like the ball carrier and that vessel, like to give the ball to Steph, to Durant, or Klay. And that's a fantastic, I'll say adjustment. You want to say concession, because he's been making it for essentially 2 years now. And then two, gut feeling, do you think he successfully defends his Defensive Player of the Year award?
First, the shooting, you know, 2 years ago, he shot it better than anybody possibly could have ever expected. And until I see another year like that, I'm going to view that as the outlier. And last year was, it got a little rough. You know, his shot mechanically is never, I shouldn't say never, because he shot whatever it was, like 40% 2 years ago. But it's flat. He misses short a lot. He's got this weird lean in. It's not one that lends itself to looking at it and saying like, well, that guy's definitely shooting 38%, like for, you know, indefinitely. I think it's we're going to see closer to what he was last year than 2 years ago as far as his shot. But I think the real thing with him is, like, he's undersized, and his game, as much as it's based on smarts, is also based on just in ridiculous athleticism, like weird athleticism, like quickness and anticipation. And when that starts to go, maybe that's when you worry about the Warriors, like, losing a piece of themselves they can't replace. I don't see that happening this year, which is why I also think he is going to repeat. And whenever you do this, whenever you talk about Green's defense and him being the best defender in the league, which I think he is, you get murdered by Rudy Gobert stands. And Rudy Gobert is also not afraid to, like, retweet your articles with the eye emoji, which he did when I did the Who You Got, Draymond Green or Kawhi Leonard, which maybe he doesn't understand that sometimes assignments are just two guys and you don't get to mention a third. but, like, I think Gobert could be as good a defender as Green this year, but he's just not going to get seen. And DPOYs repeat, like, a lot. I think it's been around since 82-83, the award has, and I think there have been 9 back-to-back winners. And guys like Ben Wallace have, like, 4, and Dwight Howard's got a bunch. So I think since defense is so hard to follow and measure, once a guy wins it, there's this huge bias that gets into his favor, not that Green needs it, and they just win more. Like, that's what I see happening as much as anything.
I almost go the other way. I do think he's the best defender in the league, and some of it's just physical limitations. Rudy Gobert does a lot for a big guy. Like,
he's great.
He defended more spot ups than Gordon Hayward last year. Like,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Good stat.
Yeah. So that's that to me, like, that's just incredible. And for a big guy, again, he does so much more than just protect the rim. And I could see, not that Green's going to suffer from voter fatigue, but for the past 3 years now, we've been talking about, like, Kawhi versus Draymond. And Rudy Gobert kind of wedges his way into that discussion. So I favor him for the award this year, but there's so much of me feels uneasy about that because Green just has more responsibility. And if the voters recognize that, like, if this doesn't become necessarily, a lot of times these awards they're so driven by narratives, but if you're looking at it and you really watch the way Draymond Green defends, like, that's nothing against Rudy Gobert. He can't shoulder all those responsibilities because, you know what? He shouldn't be switching onto point guards from, you know, outside the 3-point line. And that's not what he does. He'll close out on them. He defends in space better than probably any traditional big in the game. But, like, he's just never going to have those extra duties that Green has because he is just such this unique player. And, I you know, the Defensive Player of the Year Award, it's not, to me, it's not always a referendum on who the actual best defender in the NBA is. Just like we know the MVP is not the end-all be-all on who's the best player in the league. We know it's LeBron James, even though he doesn't win the award anymore. So I actually don't know where to go, and I just lean towards Rudy Gobert because I think the Warriors get so much shine, and, you know, we've talked about this kind of uprising from the Rudy Gobert stands, and I think even some writers are, like, kind of, they get, it's not even just Jazz writers, but they get sensitive to it, and there are some who want to push back against this idea that, you know, big guys, like, they still really matter in today's NBA. And what I think would make Rudy Gobert's case ironclad and why I ultimately go with him is I still fancy the Jazz a playoff team, and not just, like, this 8th seed. Like, I think they're going to end up, like, maybe 6 or just comfortably inside the Western Conference playoffs. And if you look at him without Gordon Hayward, without George Hill anchoring that Jazz team into another top 3 defensive rating or whatever it will be, like, that's just tough to – that context is tough to refute because of the talent that he actually lost over the offseason.
Yep. First of all, I agree with you on the Jazz. This isn't the Jazz preview, but I'm on board. I think they're going to be really good.
We've turned this into a league-wide preview, and I think our listeners should thank us for just drumming up the interest.
Well, you have to with the Warriors. But, yeah, I think there's a lot to that. The narrative does, as much as it shapes up for Green, like, if the Warriors have the best defense in the league this year, which is, you know, they were, like, 0.2 of a point off of it last year, it's completely reasonable. And Green is going to get seen on national TV who knows how many times.
81 of 82, maybe?
Yeah, 81, like, probably. Yeah, I don't know. Their second game against, I don't know, Atlanta probably won't quite make it. But that's going to be hard to get past for a lot of people that, you know, defense is hard to figure, and, you know, casual voters, which unfortunately I think there are a lot still, are just going to be like, well, he was the best defensive player. It's kind of like the MVP, best player, best team type of thing. Best defensive player, best defensive team. But you're right. Gobert, if the Jazz finish top 3, which they probably should defensively, There's this nice little big man renaissance idea to be had there. There's lots of that. I could see that happening. I think Gobert could be – Gobert, by a lot of metrics, was more defensively valuable than Green last year. I think he could do that again. But, like, nobody else guards five positions really well. And nobody else plays center at 6'7". And nobody else is a prime – it's hard to, for me to get away from Green on that. But I take your point.
Yeah, the five positions thing is like there are guys that we like to think do it, and Giannis Antetokounmpo might come close one day. But even if Draymond Green's stronger, but you know that it's got to be like a 5-inch like advantage that Antetokounmpo has. Like Green's a good rim protector at 6'7", which right. is just like that's all like just smarts and anticipation. It's not like oh he's just out leaping. You know he'll out leap some of these guys, but he's just. He's so good, and he is the best defender in the NBA. And I know Zach Lowe has said this a bunch of times over at ESPN.com. He might be, just like in pure function, the best defender the NBA has ever has, because who has ever had to ferry this type of switchability? And the answer is no one, I would think.
No, and just quick stat as I was looking this up, Gobert averaged opponents shot 48.9% within 6 feet with Gobert as the primary defender. Green was 48.3%. Now, Gobert defended two more shots inside per game, but like when you're there with Gobert in terms of field goal percentage allowed at the rim, which is kind of the only area where you should ever use that stat, the various nerds have told me. That's ridiculous. Like it's if you can defend the rim at a Gobert level and you're 6'7" and you switch everywhere, it's hey, guess what? The Warriors have another thing that makes them unfair. Is basically the end of that diatribe.
Yeah, it was. And so when I was ranking the centers for BR, I was trying to just get a little bit deeper on like the quality of the rim protection. And if you look at, there was 125 players, I think. I'm doing this off the cuff from memory right now. There's 125 players who guarded at least 200 shots at the rim. And Draymond Green ranked fifth, just behind Rudy Gobert at fourth in points allowed per shot. So those are two high-volume guys. And I think Draymond Green was fourth, Rudy Gay was third, and there was the people in front of them. It was Roy Hibbert and Joel Embiid who benefited from we barely got to that 200 mark. So to do right. what those guys do in volume, like the points per shot thing of how Rudy Gobert didn't surprise me because he's a monster, but you look at Draymond Green in that volume where, yes, there was like a couple hundred shot difference, but Draymond Green still defended more than 500 opportunities at the rim, and he's going to just be so like stingy. It's incredible to me.
Yeah. I'll flip it on you. I want to ask you a question. Do you think the Warriors offense or defense will be better this year? Like if you define them by one side or the other, which you don't necessarily have to with a team like this, but which do you think will rank higher?
I think it'll be the offense just because I think the competition won't be as stiff there. San Antonio, I still believe, is going to be very good defensively. You have the Utah Jazz in that conversation. And just the other thing for me is I'm just very interested to see how Andre Iguodala, how Sean Livingston age defensively. Same thing for David West. I want to see what's the defense going to be like when they have more of these traditional bigs, when you're going to play Pachulia and McGee. Like, are those numbers going to hold? And if we're to believe that they even use Nick Young, and I'll remove him from the equation, but if everyone expects Patrick McCaw to play a little bit more, like, is he going to impact your defense, even though he's long and switchy in sort of this adverse fashion for more but minutes of a game than he obviously did last year? So I just question the offense, and also this just says more about the offense. I think the defense will still be top three in the league, but the offense, I don't think you can come close to naming one that's going to be within relative proximity to the Warriors. And I know the popular pick will be the Rockets, and like, you know, that's fine, but they just don't have, like, some of these guys are, one, new to each other, even if we think Chris Paul and James Harden are going to be seamless fits. And just look at the gap last year. Was the Warriors were 113.2 points per 100 possessions. The Rockets come in second at 101.8. Like, that 1.6 points per 100 possessions gap, it matters. And then you look at how thin the margin was defensively for the top teams. Like, the Spurs had the top defense, 100.9 points allowed per 100 possessions. The Warriors are at 101.1. So there normally seems to be a smaller gap there. And then the final thing I'll say to end this hopefully coherent rant is, even when the Warriors take nights or plays off, like, that's almost never going to show on the offensive end. Maybe there'll be turnovers, but a bad possession can still end with a made Steph three, where there'll be defensive possessions. You're playing so many for one that the score totals are going to be drummed up inherently. And then two, if you're going to take time off, like, I just feel like that's going to reflect more on the defensive side than the offensive side.
Yeah, I think that's right. The thing I would add is that if you are looking to kind of protect guys over the course of the season, I think Green is probably one that you're going to look at most. And maybe that means cutting his minutes. Maybe that means fewer minutes at center. Maybe that means, which, like, for all the offensive stuff that that does for the Warriors, it actually, I mean, defensively, it's as big a advantage as anything. You can sort of roll all the other things, if you're looking for little like vulnerabilities, into that, and point to, like, Iguodala, Livingston decline a little bit. McCaw is probably still too thin to be like a real factor defensively, except against maybe point guards, and he's not a like real great athlete to where he can stick with those guys. So if he's playing more, get a little slippage. And then the complacency angle, I totally agree. If you do see a play taken off here or there, it's not going to be offense because everybody wants their buckets, and it's hard for that offense to not just be revving all the time. So yeah, I think I agree with you on that.
That'll be interesting to watch, though, because I think you could probably also make the case that maybe it won't be, just because they are – we probably take their defense for granted at this point.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to know where to – you know, one of the things you look at with this team is their chemistry should be better, right? I mean, with basically everybody back, plus, you know, year two of Durant, no additions that are going to play huge minutes, that are going to have to be figuring things out. Like if Nick Young already is kind of out of the rotation to me, and if Caspi doesn't click right away, like, guess what? He just won't play. They'll play somebody else that is, you know, comfortable. So does the chemistry manifest itself in like smoother offense and better anticipation on that end? Or is it the defense that's tighter? Cause it's the whole five guys on a string thing. You know, you'd think that string gets a little more taut the longer you play with the same guys. So that'll be interesting to see where that sort of familiarity really is a benefit.
And I guess the last actual roster-related question to this team that everyone obviously wants to know, Jordan Bell, does he get any significant minutes beyond garbage time? Or is it, you know what, and maybe this has to be a part of the question, might we see just, you know, a little bit more urgency from the Warriors at times, and they're going to close out games quicker so that they can get Jordan Bell into the lineup?
That's always the hope for me, because, and that was true with McCaw last year, even though he started a bunch with Durant out, I just wanted to see more of him. And it's just so hard for a guy like that, as promising as everyone agrees he is, to get enough time to just get comfortable. Honestly, it's tough. Rookies are never good. That's like the truism. But it's really hard to show what you can do if you're playing 4 or 5 minutes a night in these weird spurts or garbage time. So for Bell, I, you know, to me, if you're trying to preserve Green, I think what you potentially do is give Bell some of those small ball center minutes. And that cuts into McGee's minutes a little bit. Pachulia is sort of a ceremonial starter still at this point, so maybe you trim a little bit there. Maybe you buy some minutes by, you know, taking a couple more off David West total, which I think was still only like 12 minutes a game. So there's not a lot of room to carve out time other than garbage time. But I think Bell is just, and I feel irrational thinking this way, but he just, to me, really feels like a guy that the Warriors should not have been able to get. Shout out Chicago. Thanks. Thanks for taking. Good luck. I really hope you make that $3.5 million work for you, or whatever it was. I'm sure you're going to be able to get like a nice, you know, you can really spruce up one of those two-way G League contracts with that. You can really sweeten the pot. But he's just like, he's a center. He's small. He's super athletic. He's a really smart defender, and he plays insanely hard. So I don't really see how he fails in the right situation. And like, famous last words, right? Like, plenty of guys have failed in it, but it just, the pieces add up for me. So to the extent they can carve minutes for him, I think they have to try, especially because he's the type of guy, these cheap cost, relatively cheap, but you got paid a lot for a second rounder, and got a third year, I think, which is rare. But that's the type of guy you need to get something out of sooner than later if you're going to keep a team together, because the cost just gets so exorbitant with your stars. So I hope they play him. It's also possible that, like, you just can't justify playing him over McGee, who's awesome for his short stints. So it's going to be tough. But I think everybody out here is like, it's McCaw this is a term that probably shouldn't actually mean anything, but it's like macaw levels of excitement, which is to say it's high and unreasonably high for a guy that is a second rounder. But that's where he is. I think he could be a player. I just don't know when he's going to play.
So basically, he's the next Draymond Green, is what you're trying to say.
Basically, is what I'm saying. You can put that on the description of this episode.
Yeah, I'm retitling it as we speak. And this is actually an interesting question for this team as we put a bow on it, is what do you see their ceiling as and what do you see their floor as? And again, you don't have to assume like any crazy injuries when you're talking about the floor. You don't have to assume that they get Paul George for salary filler when you're looking at their ceiling.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll do the floor first. If we rule out injuries of any significance, I think the floor is still like 64 wins.
That's incredible to say and it not to sound crazy. And it
like, is that low though? Is my question, does that feel low? I mean,
anything
if they won
below 65, just if you, because this team has won 67, 73, then 67, and now has Kevin Durant for the first time, like through his second training camp, like he's not new. And so anything below 65 almost feels like inadequate to say.
Right. And so yeah, I'll put it there. It's absurd. I just don't know. We've spent this whole podcast talking about like reasons they might be better and trying to talk ourselves into reasons they might be worse. And so I think you have to just reflect that in the number. The ceiling is, I mean, the short answer is sort of whatever they want it to be. because you know, if they get after it and things click and everybody's super healthy and there's no decline from the vets, you know, could they win 75 games? Like, I mean, we're talking ceiling, like absolute upper limits of their potential. Maybe. I think personally, I think they'll win 70 games. That's where I'm putting it at. With the caveat that they could absolutely win more if it is a priority, or if for some incredible reason, the Rockets are pushing them for that top seed and they stay interested and they need to secure home court. That type of thing. But the ceiling is almost impossible to calculate, other than to say like they can win more games than anyone has ever won if it's a priority for them.
Do you think there's an like a point where it could ever become a priority? Like if they all of a sudden look up and it's, you know, we're 35-1, that just, you know, is there any time where they'll just then decide to go for it? Or is it going to have to be, you know, if they're close, like in there and like they've got there organically and they already have 72 wins and there's like three games left or something, maybe.
I think it's weird to say, but they're almost going to have to back into it. Like they got so, I think they're so snake bit from 2 years ago where winning 73 was absolutely a priority. They said they didn't care about it all along. And then they admitted after the fact to a man that they did care about it. And it hurt them, among other things. So I think that it will have to be organic. It will have to be, well, hey, look at that. We just went on like a 28 game winning streak. And if we, you know, why don't we just keep this going? But hey, listen, nobody's playing more than 32 minutes tonight, guys. So if you want this win, you got to do it in the first three quarters, like that type of thing. They're not going to gun for it. I just don't see any scenario where they do that. The hope, I guess, if you want that record is that they do get pushed by somebody in the West. But being pushed to win 62 games is very different than being pushed to win 74, 75. I just don't know if there's as much better as the West got. I don't know if there's that kind of quality.
I wonder if, so the NBA's like new resting guidelines where it's basically taboo if guys aren't actually injured to rest them on national television. And we know the Warriors are going to play a million national television games. I wonder if that's the argument in favor of them backing into it because, yeah, there's ways around these rules, but like it's particularly or exponentially more difficult for the Warriors than other teams because they play on national television in these marquee matchups so often.
Well, here's the other thing. I know this is way too long already for how many games are they going to win question, but so getting rid of 4 games in 5 nights and just more generally expanding the schedule, having more rest in between games, this benefits the really good teams because you know, you don't have these scheduled losses where like somehow the Suns beat you because you're playing your fourth game in 5 nights and you're on the back end of a back-to-back. It's going to emphasize the talent disparity. Like these bad teams are not going to steal schedule wins. And the good teams, I think, my guess is, are not going to lose as many so-called scheduled losses just because you're not going to have this crazy stretch of games where you're on the road for 8 and you finally get home and somebody comes in and beats you because you're just wiped out. I think it's going to affect that. So if you're looking at the win total, that's another reason to just sort of, with all these, you know, high-end teams, to sort of look to the bigger totals.
So 78-4 confirmed.
78-4, if not just 82-0, why not?
Yeah, why not? The question we didn't get to, and I actually thought the bulk of the podcast was going to be spent on it, but it went nicely, I thought. Is there anyone, or who do you think is the worst matchup for the Warriors in the West? I think the reflexive answer has been the Rockets, and I find myself being just super intrigued by the Thunder, if only because I like the potential of a death lineup with them when you stash Patterson at the five.
Yeah, I think I agree. I still think the Cavs are the best opponent, and like, it's just irrespective of the moves they made or whatever, just because they have LeBron, and LeBron's the best player in the world, and he actually did beat them one time, so and nobody else did that, so let's get simple about it. But I think it is probably the Thunder, just because they have the bodies to sort of get a bunch of like-sized guys out there that can shoot and run around and switch. And, you know, if you're going to try to beat the Warriors and you're not going to junk it up like the Cavs did when they won that title, you got to try to run around with them. And I think the Thunder probably have the best roster to do that. But I don't know where you put Carmelo. I don't know who he hides on. He's going to get targeted. And, you know, you can't put Robertson out there because the Warriors don't guard him.
Yeah,
Adams can't play because the Warriors won't guard him. So it's interesting. And the Rockets are intriguing. And the Spurs, I don't think the Warriors have been afraid of the Spurs for a long time. But they're always there. I guess I'd go Thunder too, just because of the size, the like-sized guys they have that can all play.
The party kind of changes there if Isaiah Thomas comes back healthy and continues to be – he was better than Kyrie Irving the past 2 years. But even if he ends up being a lateral move, like, I'm not going to buy into – he's more of a liability on defense just because of his size. But then you've all of a sudden – you have this lateral move on offense at point guard, and you added Jay Crowder, who is one of the most versatile defenders in the league. So that might be that's something to consider with the Cavaliers as well. It's just getting him in that trade. That's arguably – the bigger immediate boon for them, just because we know LeBron can be the playmaker. They already had Derrick Rose on the roster. You knew Dwayne Wade was going to end up there at some points. There was always going to be someone to feed the ball to other people. But getting Jay Crowder, the conversation, it doesn't make the Cavaliers close to favorites in that discussion, but it makes you think, like, hey, if we get round four, as we're probably going to, there might be a different layer to it, maybe a little bit more drama. Who knows?
Yeah, man, that's my hot take. That was my hot take of the summer, that I would have done that deal if I'm the Cavs if all I was getting back was Crowder and the pick. I just think
I'm with you.
That Crowder is like, he's the type of player that you want if your goal is to beat the Warriors, and that can be Cleveland's only goal at this point. And the pick is just, I mean, it's gravy. I think, you know, if you want to defend Kyrie a little bit, it's like, that is the type of guy that's nice to have in a finals where he can give you like 45 and he can create shots for himself, and he might be somehow more dangerous than Thomas that way, although clearly you're right, Thomas was a better player last year, but Crowder is I should have given him a little more shine in saying the Cavs are the real big threat to the Warriors insofar as there is one.
Yeah, and if LeBron resigns and you try and use that first pick to coax Chris Middleton and Malcolm Brogdon out of Milwaukee over the summer, that's when the Cavs actually become an interesting challenger to Golden State.
Yeah, I agree.
Grant, thank you so much for being extremely generous with your time today. I am super excited about how this podcast went, because it didn't go in any way, shape, or form how we thought it was going to compared to our precast discussion. If anyone wants to talk to Grant about his piping hot takes on the Warriors, please do follow him on Twitter at GT_Hughes. That's GT_HUGHES. He's a fantastic Twitter follower. I don't know how he has sub 1,000 followers. He tweets these just great, clever, witty things. If he tweeted more often, I'm sure he'd have more followers, but you need to follow him and check him out at Bleacher Report, where he's a national NBA featured columnist, writes some great stuff there as well. If you want to talk to me, I'm at Dan Favale. That's Favale. You can follow Andy Bailey at Andrew D. Bailey, spelled exactly as it sounds. Please follow our parent sponsor, MBA Math, at MBA_Math. And you can get at Hardwood Knox on Twitter, at Hardwood Knox. please, as always, subscribe, leave a rating, leave a review, even if it's a mean one. And since Andy is not here to close it out, we will not be ending with a shout out to you know who. Until next time.